Everything I want to say to you this morning is based upon two presuppositions. Number one, every single one of us is well acquainted with experiences of difficulty. Now, the circumstances of those difficulties certainly is unique to all of us, but nonetheless, all of us are intimately acquainted with difficulties in this life. The valley of discouraging circumstance is the context in which all of life is lived. Preposition or presupposition number two, among the greatest difficulties that we encounter is the ill treatment brought upon us by people in our lives whom we once loved. People who once loved us. People who were very close to us. I mean, there's a certain amount of pain that comes from those in whom we once trusted, we once confided in. We once experienced a joyful and loving relationship to. But later on, for whatever reason, they seem determined to seek our demise, even relishing in our suffering. I tell you, I wish that it was not so. But that's the problem of living in a fallen world. And that is even the context of life in the Christian church. And one of the marks that distinguishes a mature and healthy Christian from an immature one is how we respond to such abuse. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 44, "Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, because thus you will reveal that you are a child of God." The Apostle Paul adds to that in Romans 12:21, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." Think for a moment of how God has designed a leaf, how God has designed greenery in our world, green plants, how they function. They soak up the poisons of the air, carbon monoxide and the like. And what do they return to our atmosphere? Is it that same poison? Do they return back that which is lethal to us? Or is it just the opposite? God has designed even the greenery in our world to transform the poisons that surround it that would harm us to give off oxygen that allows us to live. We know all about that. We learned about it in the fifth grade. It's called photosynthesis. In a sense, it's like overcoming evil with good. That's exactly what both Jesus and Paul seem to be saying in those verses that I've given you. Drink in mistreatment and abuse and transform those toxins into life-giving manifestations of mercy and grace and peace and forgiveness and love. Overcome evil with good. Think about that. Doesn't that just sound like a wonderful concept? How marvelous! What a good idea! Until you've been the victim of someone's abuse. At that moment, all of this is far easier said than done. Maybe you've heard a statement similar to this before. It's been around since I've been a Christian. To return evil for good is satanic. To return good for good is human. To return good for evil, that is divine. And I don't think any one of us here would argue against that principle. I guess the real question is how? How do we overcome evil with good? It kind of goes against the fiber of every grain of fiber within us. Beloved, I tell you this. Someone insults us. Someone attacks us. Someone seeks to harm us. And the question in our Christian mind ought to be, how can we overcome that evil with good? Beloved, I tell you, to be able to do that is a significant mark of Christ-like maturity in the life of a believer. How do we overcome resentment towards those who have abused us, harmed us? How do we overcome that anger, that hostility, that desire for vengeance? It's that very question that God's going to answer to us. Finally, as we come to the end of the story of Joseph, and I think we know that Joseph is not a perfect human being, right? Never in all of these 8 weeks have we seen him walk on water. He doesn't perform any miracles. He doesn't walk around with a halo over his head. None of that. He's a believer just like you and I. He's a believer who has suffered unimaginable abuse at the hands of the very people whom he thought loved him most of all, his brothers. The question is, how does Joseph respond when given unilateral opportunity to exact vengeance upon those whom so have hurt him? We're going to find out. As we watch Joseph respond to his brothers, we're going to see in him an example that was intended to help all of us as we respond to others in their fallenness towards us. You see, all of us have a tendency to respond in kind, right? An eye for an eye. Fire against fire. It's in this story of Joseph, that we're going to find an example of how God wants us to respond towards those who've abused us. So let's begin, chapter 45 and verse 1. Then Joseph could not control himself before all of those who stood by him. Now this is not the first time Joseph's broken down in our story. It's actually the third time. And what we see is each time he has less and less ability to control his own emotions publicly. You remember last week he was so overcome by emotion. He had to run out of the room and he was so broken down that he couldn't go back out in public unless he actually cleaned himself up. But now he realizes he won't even be able to do that. He's on the verge of losing all emotional stability. Notice he cries out in verse 1, and he cried, "Have everyone go out from me." So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept so loudly that even, if you would allow me to say that, the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. Now let me give you an interesting grammatical observation here. Not only are the two opening verses to this story consumed with Joseph's tears, but so are the two final verses. Look at verse 14 and 15. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck, and he wept. And Benjamin wept on his neck. And he kissed all of his brothers, and he wept on them. That's important. The point is, Joseph's tears become the dominant theme in this entire scene of reconciliation with his brothers. And I tell you that to dismiss any thought any of us might have that Joseph is deriving some kind of perverse pleasure from all of the various stages. You remember he put his brother through last week, the various stages of anguish, in order that he might know the state of their hearts before he revealed himself to them. In fact, just the opposite is true. Joseph, we find here, is unrestrained in his love and compassion for his brothers, and that kind of tells the tale of our story, what's going on in his heart. He is so genuine in his emotion that it doesn't take long before everyone in the entire household hears, all of them who've been dismissed from the room. And evidently that promotion back in chapter 41 when Pharaoh promoted him, it was such a prominent promotion that his living quarters were moved, you remember, from the dungeon to adjacent to Pharaoh's household because all of Pharaoh's servants are here as well. Now the question is, what is it that brings Joseph to such a place of emotional explosion? And I have no doubt that this is so much of a complex confusion of emotions that are just kind of flowing out of his heart at this moment. No doubt there is a great love for his father and his brother whom he hasn't seen for 22 years. No doubt also all of the pain of the abuse that he suffered at the hands of the 10 older brothers 22 years ago. And then, of course, there's the great joy as he recognizes the genuine sorrow that's taken place in the heart of the brothers over what they did to him. And then the transformation in their hearts and that they refused to do to Benjamin when given the opportunity what they did to Joseph 22 years earlier. It's all of that emotion that you could see now in his humanness that's just pouring out of Joseph, manifest in loud cries that could be heard by anyone and everyone around. And what is it in particular that completely turns the heart of Joseph around in his relationship to his brothers? Well, you remember it was the speech given by Judah that we saw last week in the last chapter. When Judah, the one who deceived his father Jacob and gave the bloody, multicolored cloak of Joseph to Jacob and said a lion and a wild animal got to him. The very Judah who was willing to lie to give away Joseph's life now stepped forward to the prime minister of Egypt and to his father Jacob and said, "Do not take Benjamin's life, but I am willing to give my own life in his place." When Joseph heard the words of Judah, he recognized the very repentance that had taken place in the hearts of the brothers, and it triggers this flood of emotion that just is too great to hold back. So it's at this point that Joseph recognizes that the masquerade could now come to an end. And now it's time to reveal himself to his brothers. So at the dam of his emotions, bursting forth, ready to burst, he commands all of the servants, all of the officers who protect him to leave the room, all of the Egyptians. Why? I think at least two reasons. Number one, to secure privacy. And it's not that Joseph is embarrassed by his emotions or ashamed, but it's just not suitable for the prime minister to be seen in public like this. I mean, don't forget, Joseph is the second most powerful man in the entire kingdom. And as I said last week, prime ministers didn't cry in public. They made others cry in public. What goes on next needs to be private. It's far too emotional for the public eye to consume. And what this shows us about Joseph is that despite his rank and his title, despite his power and his popularity and his position, that the real identity of Joseph's heart is still bound to these brothers and their father and their family, these Hebrew shepherds who live a long ways away. Joseph still views himself first and foremost as a brother of the 11 and heirs to the promise of his great-grandfather Abraham. That's what's most important to Joseph in life. It's not his rank. It's not his social status. It's not his popularity in the empire. Not even all of the profound wealth that he's been given by Pharaoh. The most important thing, first and foremost, in the life of Joseph, he finds his identity with the people of God. What a great lesson that is for us. Number two, why does Joseph dismiss all of the Egyptians? He wants to secure the protection of the brothers. I mean, just ask yourself, what might happen to these brothers if word got out what they did to the prime minister of Egypt so many years ago? I mean, remember, Joseph's the man who saved the entire empire from a severe famine. He's loved and he's revered in all of Egypt. I mean, what might become of those who so cruelly treated this man who's been so good to Egypt? Not only that, by the way, we're only 2 years into the famine. There's five more years to go, and the Egyptians know that, per Pharaoh's dream and Joseph's interpretation. And if they harmed Joseph so long ago, what might they do to Joseph now? And we need Joseph because all of Egypt is depending on Joseph to get us through this famine. Any attack on Joseph would be looked as an attack on Pharaoh, which would be looked as an attack on Egypt, and that wasn't going to happen. And by the way, if there was any vengeance in the heart of Joseph towards his brothers, all he had to do is keep everybody in the room, tell the story of what they did to them, and that would be the end. What they did to him, that'd be the end of them. You've heard of this term before, right? Blacklist. It's a term used in our country, usually for those who would desire to take vengeance on others. I did some reading this week on the term. It was actually finding its origin back in the 1600s in England, I believe, England or France, one of those two. It was the man Charles II, upon his ascension to the throne, that made a list of 58 names of those he thought were involved in the assassination of the previous king, Charles I, his father. And over the first few years of his kingship, he had assassinated or imprisoned 38 of the 58 on the blacklist, and the other 20 he couldn't find, but they stayed on his blacklist for the rest of his life. Now let me ask you, do you have a blacklist? Do you have a blacklist that you save on the hard drive on your mind? How do you feel about those who are on that list? Do you desire God's blessing for them? Or do you desire and are waiting for harm to come to them? And are you kind of patiently biding your time, waiting for the right opportunity so you can get them back for whatever real or unreal what you perceive they've done to you? I mean, how do we respond when someone harms us? And then the opportunity for vengeance presents itself. Someone abuses us. Someone insults us. Someone attacks us. They go after our reputation. How do we respond? Do we cut them right down at the knees, right on the spot? Seeking to ruin their reputation, embarrass them before others? I mean, all the while justifying our actions based on this righteous indignation that we're holding up against them. Always remember this, brethren, when you read the Bible, that the characters in Scripture, they're not as much models of morality as they are mirrors of humanity. Specifically in our story, the case of the brothers. I mean, who do you see yourself as in this story? Is it the brothers? 22 years earlier, their hearts were filled with jealousy, with anger, with rage, with vengeance. Or as a child of God, do you see yourself more like Joseph? No desire to get even, no desire for rage, no blacklist, no vengeance to be seen. The fact is, Joseph's only concern here is not his own well-being, not vengeance, but the well-being of the brothers. That's why he dismisses everybody from the room. And that's so unlike most people. I mean, how do you overcome resentment towards those who've abused you? Let's watch how Joseph does it, all right? Verse 3. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? Now, on one hand, he already knows the answer to that question, because in the previous chapters, you remember, he asked that question and Judah gave him an answer. But at that point, he was an outsider. He was the prime minister of Egypt. And so Judah gave an answer that you'd give to an outsider when you'd speak about intimate family members. You kind of speak in generalities. But now Joseph reveals himself as an insider. And he wants his brothers to reveal to him all of the intimate details of that he has so longed to hear about the family members he loves so much. And notice the grammatical change here. Every time up until this point in the story, when Joseph's referred to Jacob, it's always been your father, your father, your father. Now it's my father. Is my father still alive? You said he's okay. Is he really okay? Wait a minute. Isn't this the prime minister of Egypt? I mean, how can Joseph call him his father? Two Hebrew words. I am Joseph. That must have been an absolute heart stopper. You can imagine, right? I mean, in their worst nightmare, they never could have anticipated this. And look at their response, verse 3. But his brothers could not answer him. They're absolutely speechless, for they were dismayed. Powerful word at his presence. Dismayed, a word used to describe a person who's overcome by their own obvious and immediate doom. You're in an open field and you run face to face with a hungry lion. It's an emotion that just paralyzes with fear. And just for imagine for a moment if we could slow this whole thing down and kind of creep into the minds of the brothers and kind of capture what they're thinking in their minds at this moment. I mean, I'm not even sure they have the ability to process the reality of what they just heard. And remember, in the previous chapter, Joseph always spoke to his brothers through an interpreter, but now he's alone with them. He's speaking in their own unique language. I mean, can this possibly be? Did he say that he was Joseph? Impossible. We sold Joseph off to slavery 22 years ago. But that slave caravan was heading to Egypt, wasn't it? And this man does speak our unique Hebrew language. And he shows an over-concern for our father and our entire family. You have to imagine the emotions of fear that are now kind of running through the minds of the 10 older brothers. If this is Joseph, then he's now the prime minister of Egypt and all power is in his hands and we are standing before him completely unprotected. You can just imagine the terror in their eyes, the shortness of breath, their knees beginning to wobble and they're thinking we are dead men. And does Joseph use that fear of his brothers against them? I mean, how does he respond to them? Get on your knees. You're finished. I've been waiting for this moment for 22 long years. Is that how he responds to them? Look at verse 4. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. Now, wait a minute. You didn't get close to royalty in ancient times. I mean, there was a certain accepted boundary that you always respected. You remember the night before when they had dinner with Joseph, he sat at a table all by himself and they sat at another table because that's how it always was. And it's not that they recognize Joseph physically with their eyes. It's been 22 long years. Joseph probably looks like an Egyptian now. All his hair is shaven off. He has a certain goatee. However the Egyptians would look, he's dressed in royal garb. But it's what Joseph says next that's going to be proof positive. Look at verse 4. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. And they came closer, shaking. And he said, I am your brother Joseph. Here it is. Whom you sold into Egypt. This was the cover-up of the century. You have to understand this. For 22 long years, the brothers never spoke a word about what happened on that day, not even to each other. Let me ask you this question. Now listen, this is just the way I think, and I'm sitting in my office this week, and I'm thinking like this. Does this moment at this meeting remind you of another meeting that maybe you could conceive in your mind? It did for me. It reminds me of what it was like in the very day I met Jesus Christ for the first time. It was that moment in time when I recognized all of my sin and all of my guilt, and I was found out, and I was discovered, and I was exposed as the scoundrel that I was, deserving of death and judgment at the hands of Holy God. And there was Jesus. As I read the scriptures and all of his holiness and all of his majesty and all of his power, listen, infinitely greater than the prime minister of Egypt. And somewhere in my mind, as I'm reading through the Gospel of John on that day 30-something years ago, I'm expecting to hear all kind of stern words of condemnation, but instead the only words that I hear are those of love and peace and joy and delight as he drew me to him. All the burden and weight of my sin begin to dissipate in my mind. Turn from your sin. Come to me and find forgiveness. Come to me so all of your sins could be washed away. Come and enjoy fellowship with me. Come and enjoy mercy with me. How could that ever be? How could that ever be? Because if we would think that they offended Joseph, I offended him infinitely greater. How could that ever be? Because Jesus Christ came and he died on the cross. And he had paid for my sins. And though in the story of Joseph, it's not that Joseph paid for the sins of the brothers, but he certainly experienced the consequences of their sins. And what he wants his brothers to know is that he will not hold their sin against them, but that he is willing to forgive them and that he loves them. You see, Joseph understands that it's not his place to exact vengeance upon his brothers, but it's his place to offer them forgiveness, the forgiveness that true repentance always brings. Verse 5. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Joseph, how can you do this? How in the world can you keep from venting the full force of your vengeance upon those who brought such abuse upon you? Think about it. How many people do you know who would be absolutely delighted at this very moment to be in Joseph's place? And maybe once you found yourself in that category as well, right? I certainly did. Years ago, I heard a story about the gruesome act of head shrinking that would take place among the Amazon people down in South America. After they would go to battle with their enemies, they would take the slain enemies, they would cut off their heads, they would bring the heads back to the village, and they would go through the process of shrinking those heads, whatever that would be, and then each warrior would take a shrunken head back to his home and he would hang it in a prominent place. And as the warrior's children grew up, he would constantly tell his children, "These are the people we hate. Take a good look at that face. These are the people we hate." In other words, never forgive them, never love them, always seek to do them harm. You think about that. Is that not the world in which we live? Is that not what is taking place now, even on the international scene? Tragically, it's also the practice of so many of God's children who keep their own secret little blacklist in the corner of their minds. I mean, we hang the heads of those who've insulted us, who've wronged us, who've abused us. We hang their heads somewhere in the dark corners of our minds as a reminder we're never to forgive, we're never to forget what they've done to us. So we're left asking ourselves the question again, Joseph, what kind of man are you that you would respond to those who've abused you in such a horrible way, and you would respond with mercy and love and forgiveness towards them? So how do you overcome resentment towards people who've abused you? I'm going to give you at least part of the answer from this story. And here it is. By seeing your abuse in the greater context of God's sovereign providence in your life and the lives of those around you. Just look at what Joseph says next, verses 5 through 9. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Here it is. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land for these 2 years. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now therefore it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord over all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say unto him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all in Egypt. Now, before we go in any detail about all of the profound words that Joseph says here, let me give you an important point that I don't want us to forget, all right? Because it becomes unique to our church among so many other churches around us. And that is this: in seeking to discern all of life, in seeking to categorize life, what's going on in my life, theology is absolutely vital to a proper understanding. That's why we teach the Bible as we do. That's why it's the center of what we do. We teach it richly. We teach it deeply. More than anything else, we teach it theologically. We teach it theologically because when it comes to discerning all of the complexities of life and any part of life, theology is absolutely vital to a proper understanding. Listen, as long as life is just going great, then sermonettes for Christianettes may seem sufficient. 7 principles on how to be a better pet owner. 6 ways to combat sibling rivalry. Shallow, pithy, make you laugh, feel good sermons. But when life gets complicated, chaotic, painful, unbearable, overwhelming, and even tragic, it's only at that moment that we're able to discern life and handle life properly if we have a right theology to carry us through. Whether it's a pink slip, an unexpected illness, the abuse of a loved one, a miscarriage, a teenager goes off the rails, it's only a living and healthy theology that will sustain us triumphantly through times of great difficulty. A proper theology will support us, it will sustain us, it will resurrect our faith again and again and again. Listen, we've gone over the story of Joseph here in the last 8 or 9 weeks with a fine-tooth comb. It reads like a nightmare. Like a nightmare of abuse and anger and vengeance and suffering. There's been deceit, there's been violence, there's been injustice, there's been disappointment, there's been incredible heartache. And here now Joseph has the opportunity in one swoop of vengeance to make it all right towards his brothers. And yet he refuses to do so. Are you kidding me? I mean, what is it that held Joseph together, not even just for the 22 years, but how about the 12 long dark years in an Egyptian dungeon? Why is it when brought face to face with his brothers, there's not even the slightest hint of vengeance? Everybody out of the room, I've got to protect these guys. Not towards his brothers, by the way, not towards the Ishmaelite slave traders, not towards the lying wife of Potiphar, and not towards the forgetful cupbearer. Here's Joseph's answer. Let me give it to you. Follow me. The end of verse 5. Why no vengeance? For it was God who sent me before you to preserve life. The beginning of verse 7, God sent me before you. Beginning of verse 8, now therefore it was not you who sent me here, but God. The middle of verse 9, God has made me Lord of all of Egypt. That's the theology that we need as believers as we live in a fallen world. It's the kind of theology that can break a cycle of resentment and anger and bitterness and vengeance. Joseph interprets all of life around him through the theology of the marvelous, powerful, sovereign providence of God, including the actions of evil people against him, actions which he said God uses for his good. And listen, let's back up for a second. Please understand this. This doesn't mean that their sin has no consequence. And this doesn't mean that God's not going to deal with them in their sin, and he has dealt with them in their sin, and he will continue to deal with them in their sin. Just because God has chosen to use their sin to accomplish a righteous end does not mean that sin has ceased to be sin. In fact, you read the entire story over again. Joseph never minimizes their sin. He never denies their sin. He just denies his right to exact vengeance towards them because of their sin. Look at verse 5 again, because it's this verse that ought to shape the very world in which we live. Verse 5, the center of the story. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. There's already been repentance. There's been confession. There's been transformation. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Let me try to sum up what Joseph's saying here. You acted, and then God acted. And God's actions overrode your actions in my life. Now, God didn't force you to act. You're responsible for your actions. But in my life, God acted in a way that used your evil against me and turned it into good. Let me say it another way. You acted according to your nature. God acted according to his nature. And amazingly, his eternal purposes in all of our lives have been achieved. Let me say it again. God's providence is so sovereign that he could use the evil acts of sinful men to accomplish his glorious and eternal purposes in the lives of his children. That's sovereignty, by the way. And notice the purpose again, the end of verse 5. God sent me before you to preserve life. Verse 7, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on the earth. That's the kind of sovereignty that empowers us to endure circumstances, chaos, calamity, knowing that God is continually working in our lives, even the evil acts of others, to work his good eternal purposes in the lives of those he loves. This is also how we can feel free to forgive those who've abused us. Now, was their abuse evil? Yes, it was. Will God deal with them to that end? Yes, he will. Can God take their evil abuse towards us and use it for our good? Yes, he desires to do that. And it's that theology that becomes the basis which we can forgive those who have slighted us or who have really harmed us, as opposed to seeking to exact vengeance upon them. You see, because their pain towards us has been filtered through the providence of God, thus we can be certain that there is divine purpose through which God will accomplish in their evil against us. And this is why Joseph can exercise such grace. Look at verse 9. Hurry and go to my father and say to him, thus saith your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not delay. You shall live in the land of Goshen, Egypt, and you shall be near me, and you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will also provide for you, for there's still 5 years yet of famine to come. You didn't know that. And you and your household and all that you have will be impoverished. Two things stand out in Joseph's words here. Number one, the immediacy. Hurry, go, do it now. Joseph knew what the brothers didn't know. This 2 years has just been the tip of the iceberg. There's 5 more years to come, and it's going to get increasingly worse. Number two, notice how personal Joseph makes this. The end of verse 9. come down to me. Begin at verse 10. You shall live in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me. Begin at verse 11. Then I will provide for you. That's the grace and kindness that Joseph extends to those who have given him such harm towards him. Verse 12. Behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth which is speaking to you. Now, you must tell my father of all the splendor in Egypt and all that you have seen, and you must hurry and bring my father down here. Just stop for a moment and just take note of this. So far in this newly discovered relationship here now, there's been all talking and no touching. And really, for the most part, Joseph's been the one doing all of the talking. The brothers are, there's a certain amount of confusion here over this reality that's been uncovered, and there's still no doubt a lingering fear about what's going to really happen next. But it's what Joseph does next that really brings reconciliation to its full end. Notice the compassion of Joseph seen in his physical movement towards the brothers. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck, verse 14, and wept. And Benjamin then began to weep on his neck. And he kissed all of his brothers and he wept on them. And afterwards his brothers finally began to talk to him. How do you overcome resentment towards people who've abused you? By seeing the abuse and the context of the providence of God in our lives. Now listen, you might be thinking this because I often think this. All right. The evil actions of others towards me, did God intend those actions to come upon Joseph? Or did God just kind of allow those actions to come upon Joseph? Well, at that point, we're beginning to move far beyond my pay grade. But if you would demand an answer for me, did God really intend this? Or did they do it and he allowed it? I would say in the story of Joseph, the answer is yes and yes. You say, I don't understand how all of that works. Join the club. No one really understands about all of that but God. What we do know is God is not the author of the evil actions of the brothers, and at the same time, we understand that God both allows and intends those actions to fall upon Joseph. That's clear in the story. And he does so for Joseph's good, for their good, for the good of many others, all of Egypt, and to be honest, when we trace the story through to the end, for our good as well. And here's the point we need to understand. We often focus on who am I going to blame? You know, this hurts, who am I going to blame? I'm going to blame them, I'm going to blame God. It's not as much our job to focus on who we're going to blame as it is our job to recognize and accept God's good purposes in our lives in the circumstances that He has brought our way. You see, because the circumstances that come our way have been filtered through the sovereignty of God, therefore we can always be certain they have a divine purpose. And what is God's purpose in our story? Well, Joseph tells us again, the end of verse 5. For God sent me here to preserve life. Now this is rich. God sent me here to preserve life. What's the purpose? To preserve life. What's the purpose? Rescue. What's the purpose? Salvation. Well, isn't that something? Because does that not remind us of the entire book of Genesis, that it's been all about salvation from the very beginning in chapter 3, when Adam and Eve fell in the garden and all of humanity fell with them, there needed to be a salvation to rescue lost sinners from eternal damnation. And the story of Genesis plays out like that in story after story after story. Noah saved from the flood. Abraham saved from paganism. Isaac saved from the sacrifice. Lot is saved from Sodom. Jacob saved from Egypt. And now here, all of the covenant family is saved from a severe famine. I mean, there you have it. Saved, saved, saved. And get this, what's the word Genesis mean? It means origins, or we might say beginnings. And what does that tell us? It suggests that all of these many salvations that happen in the book of Genesis are just a precursor to a greater future salvation that will come. You see, the book of Genesis points us forward to the ultimate salvation. that God will provide not for just 10 brothers, not for just 70 members of a covenant family, but for all of the elect sinners who he will bring to himself. The book of Genesis, in a sense, is a book that was intended to kind of set up a trajectory of the ultimate salvation that finds its pivot in the redeeming work of Jesus Christ on the cross. You see, the cross is the place where people acted. And then God acted, and his actions overrode their actions. Well, did God make those people act that way? No. They acted freely on their own. In the first Christian sermon, Acts chapter 2 and verse 23, Peter says, "You are guilty, you killed Jesus." Well, did the people make God act the way he acted? No. Peter goes on to say, right in that same verse, it was all part of the predetermined eternal plan of God for the ages. So here we are in the very first Christian sermon, and it's filled with theology. God didn't make you act. You're responsible. But God acted, and his actions overrode your actions. You acted according to your nature. He acted according to his nature. And God used your evil acts to accomplish the greatest good the world ever known, the salvation of repentant sinners. I mean, how amazing. All of their sin, all of the brothers' wickedness only serve to fulfill the eternal purpose of God saving his elect. How about this? Just as God sent Joseph to suffer in Egypt to save the covenant family, God sends Jesus to suffer in the world to save his covenant people. And God does it all, not in spite of human sin, but through the very means of human sin. Psalm 78 and verse 10, God even uses the wrath of man to praise him, right? Why are you telling us all this, Pastor? So that we'll understand that nothing ever happens in our lives that's not been filtered to us per the sovereignty of God, with an intended divine purpose for our good and the good of those around us. You see, every abuse is God-filtered, and thus every abuse is purpose-filled. And I tell you, this theology is absolutely essential for living life in the fallen world. Why people try to deny this? Why people try to make believe that there, you know, there is no sovereignty, and they turn a blind eye to sovereignty, and they want to tinker with the doctrine of sovereignty. You know, God can't be that sovereign. In my mind, that's the height of foolishness. I would never want to get out of bed in the morning if I didn't think God was sovereign over the whole rest of my day. This theology is absolutely indispensable to our survival as we live in a fallen world. And that's the heart of the story of Joseph, that God is far bigger than you and I ever imagined, and he, at the same time, he is far more loving to his children than we've ever recognized. He is big, and that he's absolutely sovereign over every event that comes into our lives. Even the evil acts of others he uses for his eternal purpose. And he is big and he is loving in that everything that comes into our lives he uses for our good. And that's why I tell you that theology is not irrelevant. Theology is not impractical. It's how we survive. So how do you overcome resentment towards those who've abused you? By seeing your abuse in the greater context of God's sovereign purpose. Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me here to preserve life. People act, God acts, and his act overrides their act. Let's bow for prayer. Men, will you come, please?